Welcome to City Arts and Lectures, a season of talks and onstage conversations with some of the most celebrated writers, artists, and thinkers of our day, recorded before an audience at the Sydney Goldstein Theater in San Francisco. This week, a conversation with music critic, essayist, and poet Hanif Abdurraqib. Abdurraqib's writing fuses cultural commentary with intimate poetic language. His subjects, everything from A Tribe Called Quest to his own childhood in Columbus, Ohio, Bruce Springsteen to Muhammad Ali. Abdurraqib's latest collection, A Fortune for Your Disaster, wrestles with histories both personal and shared, the process of rebuilding after heartbreak, and the people and things that help us heal. On May 29th, 2020, Hanif Abdurraqib and Jeff Chang spoke via video conference. Just as Black Lives Matter protests were starting across the country, the two talked about the power of storytelling, shared grief, and the music they love. Join us now for a conversation with Hanif Abdurraqib and Jeff Chang.
Hi, and welcome to another session of City Arts and Lectures. My name is Jeff Chang, and today we are incredibly happy to host Hanif Abdurraqib. He's one of my favorite writers who's out there working today, one of my favorite thinkers. And Hanif, I'm just so happy to be able to be here in place with you today. We're actually recording this on May 29th, 2020, which is a day that feels very heavy in many kinds of ways, and wanted to maybe talk about that. But first of all, just welcome, and it's so nice to be here with you on a day like this.
Yeah, no doubt. Thanks for having me, Jeff. I really appreciate being here.
So let's start here. You're in Columbus, Ohio. This is where you were born and raised.
Yeah.
Want to talk a lot more about the geography of Columbus. But today, you know, there's a lot of heaviness, I think, in the air, both for you and for me. We're, of course, talking about the day after protests broke out across the country, the second night of protests around the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And there were massive protests across the country yesterday, including in Minneapolis, in Louisville, where seven people were shot, and in Denver, where shots were fired at people as well, and somebody attempted to run over one of the demonstrators. There were also protests at the state capitol in Ohio, in Columbus, where you live. How are you feeling today? Where are you at, man? I just wanted to start off with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think overwhelmed and exhausted feel like the best words that come to mind. You know, I was out last night with the protesters. You know, I'm someone who's organized in Columbus for a long time. But what feels different about this moment is that, I mean, in short, so many more people are activated than they were before. You know what I mean? I think when we start talking about the reopening of America, quote unquote, you know, it's America's reopening with this level of violence and this level of resistance against America's violence seems unfortunately apropos. But I was heartened last night to see way more people out in force in Columbus than I think would have been before the pandemic. I think that this these past few months have ignited something in people who have seen more plainly that the country is held up by workers, the country is held up by folks at the margins, the country is held up by folks who are often put in vulnerable positions by those in power. And so there's some hope for me in what the future of organizing in our cities looks like. And, you know, I'm just a person who grew up here and who loves it here. And I don't really crave any kind of role of leadership or anything like that. I just kind of go where the people are and see where I'm needed.
I mean, I got to tell you, Hanif, like, I've been reading your work for years and years, and it's been really sustaining me through these periods as well. I, like you, I'm a writer, have been doing a lot of organizing and cultural work for many years. And your voice has always been one that has been incredibly incisive, incredibly. There's so many words I could use to describe it, but incredibly comforting, actually, to be able to know that I'm not alone, that there are people out there who are actually beacons who I can follow and who are pointing the way for us to be able to process and think about all of these events, especially the events, I think, of the last 7 years, six, 7 years. First of all, thank you for all of that. It's just a note of gratitude.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it.
And just to be able to say that all of your books, all four of your books, rereading them again, I think, in the light of the last 2 months, 2.5 months under coronavirus, as we've been sheltered in place and hopefully doing a lot more reading. But also, especially too, with the events of the past week, right? From Central Park, with Christian Cooper and Amy Cooper. Then, of course, the killing of George Floyd, and recognizing that Black and Brown folks are disproportionately dying, being infected by coronavirus, much, much higher levels, and recognizing that the protests to open the country happened when those statistics started coming to light, that suddenly it's like, oh, it's not affecting me,
right?
As a white person or that kind of thing, but it's burdensome for me to actually have to feel like I have to be taking care of these other folks. They should be delivering me my Amazon goods and my food and all this other kind of stuff. Anyway, I should stop ranting here. But I just want to say that it's been very comforting to be able to read your work and reread your work in the last month. So I had a lot of questions for you. I wanted to start by talking about Columbus and the sort of centrality that it's played in the way that you write and in your particular kind of point of view, and particularly in terms of the geography of Columbus, where you grew up. Can you tell us a little bit about Columbus for those of us maybe who are out here on the coast who might have any kind of idea?
Yeah. So I grew up on the east side of Columbus, Ohio, which is, or at least the portion of the east side I grew up on, was and remains in some ways a bit of a neglected community, but a deeply loved community. A community of largely Black folks and like very working class. And, you know, a funny thing is when people talk about police abolition in particular, right? People always ask, like, what will we do without police? But if you grow up in a neighborhood that's, if you grow up in a neighborhood that's either wealthy enough or violent enough or neglected enough, you don't see police much. You know what I mean? Like, I grew up in a neighborhood where police didn't come, even though, you know, it was so neglected and it was so on the margins that police didn't even patrol it because they didn't care if people stole from the stores, if they didn't care if people, you know. And so while there are like a lot of Black neighborhoods that see disproportionate policing, mine wasn't one of them because police just didn't care. But what that did was create an ecosystem for me where I understood the strength in a caring community of people and how that in and of itself makes policing obsolete, right? And to grow up in the Midwest loving music like I did, I think really enhanced my imagination, especially hip hop, because I grew up, I came into my own as a person who loved music in the 90s and as a person who loved hip hop in the 90s, which meant that it was happening largely far away from me. You know, first on the coast and then in the South, always in the South Shore, but more robustly in the South as the 90s went on. And in some ways, I had to imagine the world that was being built in these songs. I remember when, like, The Chronic came out. I remember when Doggy Style, The Chronic, and Death Row kind of took over. I had never been to California. I had never seen anything in California. And so I was kind of living out my fantasies of California through these music videos. Or through these descriptions of what summer in California could be like. You know, Outkast came out with Players Ball, the first Outkast album. I'd never been to Atlanta. I didn't know what Atlanta was like. And so in some ways, you know, New York, I had most of my family's from New York. And so I'd been to New York, I'd seen New York. It was easy for me to have these really touchable visions of Brooklyn specifically, in Queens specifically, in Jersey too. But almost everywhere else, it was so great to fall in love with rappers who were storytellers, because what they were doing was building a geography for me that I didn't have access to. And so that was, I think, something really defining about my time growing up, as a, particularly as a music fan in the middle of the country.
Was it the kind of thing where hip hop was able to kind of give you a sense of sort of this larger, maybe national, global kind of Black imagination?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, and I think too, you know, the biggest thing for me wasn't the wealth and opulence and aesthetic beauty that hip hop sometimes offered. Although I loved that. I mean, I love the Hype Williams video as much as anyone else, you know what I mean? But like,
The shiny suited era.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a shiny suit apologist, honestly. Like that era, I mean, we don't have to get into it now, but that era did a lot for me as a kid.
Yeah.
Because before that, I was really, and I write about this in Go Ahead and the Rain a bit, I was so afraid that hip hop was going to, you know, after the string of violence, you know, Biggie and Pac, but also Big L, and also, you know, like, I really thought hip hop, the way that particularly white pundits would talk about it on the news and the kind of fear and hysteria that was being stirred up around it during the like 1996, early 97. You know, I was kind of young and I was like, well, this is the end of hip hop. You know, like these people are going to panic over hip hop and it will no longer exist. But and so I think the shiny suit era in some ways, despite its many casualties, I do think that this thing happened where rappers who otherwise would not bend themselves towards the shiny suit era, try to immerse themselves in it, and it really hurt career. You know, I'm thinking about like Mike Geronimo, right? Who, like who's, you know, like I think about rappers like that who kind of like tried to arc their careers towards the shiny suit era and it just didn't serve their skill set. But I have some love for the shiny suit era, but also what was happening around the time of the shiny suit era was Ohio's kind of underground rap scene was becoming, you know, like high tech and like Reflection Eternal and all this stuff was kind of bubbling up out of Cincinnati in particular. J. Rawls out of Cincinnati and then Columbus. And I got to see that up close. You know, my brother, my oldest brother went to University of Cincinnati and J. Rawls was in his fraternity. The great producer J. Rawls was in his fraternity. And so like as a teenager, you know, I would get this like very odd up close and personal look at the very, the infancy of the J. Rawls era and the high tech era. And so I had one foot in both worlds. You know, I would love, as much as I love that stuff, I would still listen to the shiny suit shit and people would clown me for it, you know, but, but I loved it. I loved it.
I had asked the question because that just seems to be a common theme. I was checking out Scarface's autobiography, which, I don't know if you read it, but it's to me, it's amazing. And he's got these whole sections where he just raps, not waxes rhapsodically about how he felt completely connected to these young kids in all of these neighborhoods all across the country, you know, long before he'd been able to go there. And then, of course, he was able to go there. And I guess one of the things that was also interesting to me is that you write a lot about the sort of, it sounded like your neighborhood was sort of a border area that you and your friends would basically ride bikes into the white suburbs, into the wealthy white suburbs and that kind of thing. Talk a little bit about that. There's a beautiful image that you have in this essay that you do on the Wonder Years, the band, the Wonder Years, about that. And, tell me what that meant to you and how that shaped the way that you heard music, because I know that you became a big fan of emo and punk and the kind of stuff that was being played in those suburbs as well.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, that music was also being played in my neighborhood differently. I mean, I came of age as a music fan at an interesting time because one, I have older siblings, which is, I think if you're someone with, and I have significantly older siblings, like 8 to 10 years older. And that's a real gift. And that was a particular gift in the early mid 90s when college radio was really massive, right? Mm-hmm. To have siblings, older siblings in college when college radio took over meant that the people who put me on to music, to quote unquote alternative music, were also Black folks largely,
yep.
right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you see and hear this stuff where some Black folks are like, oh, I grew up in the neighborhood and listening to Weezer, I got made fun of, which, you know, that just never was the case with me because I had older siblings, all my crew had older siblings, and so many of them were listening to Nirvana or Riot Girl, like Bikini Kill or Liz Phair. And, but I will say this, I think so much of my desire to kind of push myself into the suburbs was a kind of cultural archaeology or something like that, where, you know, I came up playing soccer and I came up playing sports with kids who lived in these spaces and who to me appeared to have a far richer life than I had in many ways, but also seemed to be longing for something, right? Mm-hmm. Some of that is just the trappings of youth. I think youth allows for all of us to long for that which we don't have. And I think youth lends itself to a particular dissatisfaction that kind of hovers over the eternity of whatever. But there are also some, you know, I mean, I think if you have more privileges than someone else, or you see someone who has more privileges than you, and they are dissatisfied, for me, that sparked a real curiosity. And so for me and so many of my friends, pushing further into the suburbs where we, like, clearly did not belong, felt to us like a way to figure out how to appreciate our lives a bit more, right? Mm-hmm. To go into the suburb and feel like we were victims of surveillance or neighborhood policing made pushing back into our own neighborhoods and feeling the freedom of that world far richer. But also, you know, we would just go into the suburbs and beat the kids there at like hoops. You know what I mean? Like, it was one of those things where we knew we could hoop and they couldn't, you know. It was one of those things where we go in there and put some money down on a game and then, you know, whip their ass and take the money off the game, you know. And so there's some of that hustle too.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about how that's changed now. There's sort of a way in which you write about this particular period with a sort of nostalgia for it, and that that you went away, you came back, and the city had changed. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, Columbus is ever changing, like many places, due to like rampant gentrification. But there was a point, I lived in Connecticut for about 2.5 years, and I came back from Connecticut, and there was so much of a jarring difference upon my return. And I had been back visiting here and there, but you know, it's one of those things where it's like, when you're back visiting, you don't necessarily notice all the changes. And when you move back, you're kind of like, oh, this place I used to love is different, or it's gone. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, to be young for me in the places I loved, it meant like I could go outside of the borders of my neighborhood and feel like a tourist briefly, but then return to the comforts of a space I knew. And as an adult, it often feels like I'm a tourist in the city at large, right? I'm a tourist in the city that I still love and still grew up in. But whenever we talk about, the mapping over of a place, something that we're all complicit in, I think. Like, I think it's easy to think about gentrification as something modern that only relates to buildings, but I like to think of the mapping over of a place as something that as it relates to land, right? Mm-hmm. Land entirely, right? The land that we're all on. So, you know, I began to think of it differently when I began to think of myself as complicit in the act of, you know, mapping over a place. But even with that said, I mean, I still feel at times like a tourist in the place I love, which is very isolating and very heartbreaking. But it also makes nostalgia not a useless function for me, right? Mm-hmm, yeah. Nostalgia isn't just a tool of romanticism, and storytelling isn't just something whimsical. Mm-hmm. For me, it is the rebuilding of architecture that I can't touch anymore, right? Mm-hmm. And so... it calls a more urgent action to to the idea of resurfacing story.
Mm. Let's come back to that. And we'd love to hear you maybe do some reading and that kind of thing later on if you're into it. Yeah. I'm really curious. I'm sorry. Were you going to?
No, go ahead. Oh, okay. Go ahead. Okay. I was like flipping the pages.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about music and writing. When did you come to music? Did that lead you naturally to writing? Was that poetry that you were first kind of coming to, and why? Talk a little bit about your journey there.
Yeah, actually, poetry was the last thing I came to, which is wild to think about.
Okay,
I think people think I was so I mean, I don't have any quote unquote traditional training in writing. You know, I didn't study writing in college. I don't have an MFA. And in my late teens and early 20s, I was in trouble a lot. You know, I was in and out of the Franklin County Courthouse. I was in and out of Franklin County Correction Facility. And I think for me, my path to writing was just that I knew that through a lot of things, I always loved music. And I always loved not just music as a broad entity, but I always loved the nuances of song. I came up in a household where music was constantly playing. My parents had a deep record collection. My brother, my oldest brother, had a massive cassette tape collection. You know, it was funny. He had these gigantic treasure chests full of cassette tapes. And a thing happened where, you know, he kind of came of age at a time where like the musical listening format had switched over to the cassette. And I imagine that he, like many people, was like, this is always going to be what it is. Much like when it switched to CDs, I was like, this is always going to be what it is. And I won't turn my camera to it, but like in my office right now, I still have my like my binders full of CDs that I don't play anymore, right? Mm-hmm. But so I grew up in a house of people who not only listened to music, but people who collected music, people who crafted mixtapes, people who instilled in me a desire to grow excitement around songs. And so I'm someone who made mixtapes off the radio first back as when, like a 10-year-old, you know? Yeah.
Back when mixtapes were on tapes.
On tapes, yeah. You had to like,
yeah.
And you had to, if you liked a single or a song, you had to sit by the radio and wait for them to play it, right? And a thing that I grew up remembering is the feeling of waiting a couple hours for a radio to play a song, the radio to play a song you want to record, and the feeling of hearing it, the feeling of hearing the DJ announce they're going to play it next. Mm-hmm. And I wanted nothing more than to capture and extend that feeling all the time, right? And that feeling jumping to life every time I press play on the tape I recorded it on. And so there's so much to me. And I grew up, like you said, I grew up in the punk scene, and I grew up in an era where music actively saved the life of some of my friends, myself, mm-hmm. and some of my friends. You know, I've survived a great many things because of a song or an album or a story. And so I feel like I owe music. I've always felt like I owed music a version of myself that is creative and eager and thoughtful. And I'm someone who was always excited about music and would always talk about it. And I hit a point in my early mid-20s where I began really eager to write reviews. You know, I would do this thing where people would pay me no money, pretty much, like a $25 a review. And I would just write these album reviews. I'd write album reviews that no one else wanted to hear, or, you know, no one else wanted to write. And on the punk scene, I was writing for zines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was writing for a ton of zines, which felt to me like reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Because the act of like writing in a zine for a punk scene for me was to report the news of what was going on in your corner of the scene so that it might get out to the other corners of the scene. In Ohio, that meant, you know, folks in Dayton. I'm from Columbus, but like folks in Dayton or folks in Cleveland would be reading, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how I got into writing about music. But a thing happened where, even though people were pretty much paying me nothing in the first place, people stopped paying me to write about music because they would complain about, it's funny, the things that people say about my work in praise now was not cool back then. People were saying like, oh, it's too poetic, or it meanders too much, or it doesn't get to the point enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and that was around 2010. And so I hit a point where I was like, well, maybe 2010, 2011. I hit a point where I was like, well, if people are saying my work is too poetic, I should maybe learn to write poems and try to hone this ability that I have, uh-huh. that I maybe have. And so I got into poems after that. Yeah.
So you got into poems because people were saying like, this is too poetic. It was some hip hop. Basically, you're basically you're saying I'm this. Okay, I'll show you. Right, I am what you say I am. Right,
that whole thing. Worked okay.
Yeah,
I think it worked out all right. I mean, we'll see. Yeah,
it worked out incredibly.
I think people think that I got into poems first because my first book was a book of poems.
Yeah,
but that was just because, like, at the time, you know, I didn't think anyone would care about a book of my music writing. You know, I would, at the time my book of poems came out, I didn't have a catalog or a body of work of long form music criticism. I had written a few things for Pitchfork, you know, like Jessica Hopper, who's a mentor and a dear friend, had kind of like nudged me along and, you know, made sure I got some things here and there. It's because in 2015, a piece of writing of mine, my first like foray into internet writing music criticism, went viral. Because I didn't know before I was writing music criticism in a world where, like, you know, music crit wasn't going viral a ton. But I wrote this thing about Trap Queen, about Fetty Wap, that went like massively viral. And at the time, Jessica Hopper was at Pitchfork and she was like, why don't you write a couple things for me? And those things kind of had moments too. And then she was like, I'm going to MTV. You know, you want to join? And that's kind of how the body of work began to build.
And did some amazing, amazing pieces there. I mean, just to go back, I mean, The Crowning Worth Much, amazing book, won all kinds of awards. It arrived, it was a debut book, and it arrived kind of fully formed. I mean, you had a powerful voice in there. You had an amazing story to tell. And it was the type of thing that it was really full of loss and sadness and anger and the kinds of emotions of youth that you were trying to capture. And also these mixes of sort of, I just think about how you write about being in the pit of a mosh pit of a punk show, and the kind of brutality that's happening, the kind of sexism that's happening, and at the same time also the kind of camaraderie and the kind of bond that you feel to the folks in there. And just for me, that kind of really sums up that book. I wondered, like, what made you sort of decide that this was the kind of thing that I could actually express and be able to pull together all of these different types of threads into that writing?
Yeah, with Crown, you know, I came up in an era where the Black narratives, the narratives of Black youth, were very coastal. And so I'm thinking about like Boys in the Hood and Juice and South Central and... Menace to Society, all these things, very coastal narratives of Black youth. And I was like, you know, I always thought like, gosh, there has to be something in the Midwest that reflects this. And I began editing through Crown and writing most of Crown when Good Kid, Mad City hit. And
Kendrick Lamar's album.
Yeah, the Kendrick Lamar album. Yep. And it felt to me like... in book form, there is a way to tell a story similar to that one about this character who is sometimes me and sometimes not, but always someone grappling with the same things that I've grappled with in my life, moving through a consistently changing landscape. And so the goal was to, of course, shine a lens on gentrification, but to do it in a way that is more than just like, here are a bunch of buildings that change. And inject a personal historical into it, which is why, you know, there's a series of poems in The Voice of My Barber. There's a bunch of poems that grapple with the loss of my mother, but also what it is to kind of attempt to conquer grief and try to love someone else well. And I really wanted to try to encompass all those things because all those things felt like historical and biographical and touchable. And the whole goal of the book was to make a book about this place I loved, but to map it onto a world that felt like it could be anywhere, right? So the book is distinctly, and I think specifically, about Columbus, but my hope was always like anyone who reads this could easily map these things onto their city or a place they loved once and are still trying to love well. And that's the goal of all my books. You know, like, think about the Go Ahead in the Rain too. Like, that's a book about A Tribe Called Quest, obviously. But the larger goal was to write a book about fandom and what it is to grow up loving a group. And it could be any group. If you grew up loving Styx or journey, or, you know, like I want people to be able to map these experiences onto the things I'm writing.
Let's talk a little bit about Go Ahead in the Rain. I mean, I feel like we could talk about this for hours upon hours. There's so many things to talk about it within it. But you have these pieces in Go Ahead in the Rain, which are epistolaries, excuse me. They're letters directly to the artists, and also actually to Fife's mom. And I wanted to ask a little bit about that. You know, you've done so much experimentation with form, the book of essays that you did, They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us, which I want to talk about all your books. I'm just going to fanboy here. But the thing about They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us is these essays, whether they're longer essays or shorter form types of pieces, all have a piece of you. They're all memoir, autobiography, as well as like musical analysis, the straight up kind of music type stuff, cultural critique actually happening as well, racial critique happening as well. And it seems like Go Ahead in the Rain is just a master example of which you kind of have perfected in your writing, sir. But I was really curious what you were doing with form here in terms of a direct address. I've never really seen that actually, I don't think, in music criticism as a genre. And it's rare even in personal essays. What were you hoping to do with that?
Yeah, I mean, I came up in an era where I wrote fan letters, you know, like I'm someone who wrote these things and sent them. And I am someone who grew up imagining that I was closer to the musicians I loved than I actually was. And I think a thing that about Go Ahead that bears mentioning is that I never expected any of the living members of the group to read this book or spend any time with this book. And so I got to a point, the first one I wrote was I think the Low End Theory chapter, because I was like, I don't know if I have the language on my own to talk about what the Low End Theory meant to me. I don't know if I have it in me, you know? And so the only way I think I can do this is if I lens it through this imaginary conversation I'm having where I'm just showing gratitude, or where I'm exploring or asking questions that I know I'm not going to get a response to, right? Mm-hmm. There was something really freeing in the writing of those letters because I knew that I wouldn't get a response. And so that opened it up to not just an expression of gratitude, but an examination and a curiosity that could be really free-flowing. And that did so much to fill out, the world I was trying to build around these things. And I Cheryl Boyce Taylor is a phenomenal poet, someone who I loved as a poet before I knew she was Fife's mom. You know, if you're around like poetry scenes in, as I was, I first heard her in New York at the New Yorican, and just loved the work. And then later a couple weeks later, I found out she was Fife's mom, but, it felt so important to me, to reach back and say, that, Fife also comes from a writing mother, as I did. You know, my mother also wrote. Mm-hmm. And it felt so vital to connect these threads.
Mm-hmm. Did you actually get a chance to ever interview them? Or were these letters sort of written kind of in a, from this sort of imagined kind of, as you said, imagined kind of conversation?
Oh, yeah, all imagined. I never interviewed them. This is all like an imagined type of closeness.
Oh, wow.
You know, the thing with the book, I did not want to write this book as someone who was posing as an expert on the group, or someone who was posing as the person who's writing the definitive book on the group. I wanted to give, especially because the majority of the members are still alive, the majority of the people close to them are still alive, and they should have an opportunity to write the definitive story of the group. Instead, I wanted to write a book from the perspective of a fan, who loves the group a great deal and was attempting to figure out how to best honor them.
Mm-hmm. I want to say that the first two chapters for me were some of the most beautiful writing about the sweep of African-American music that I've ever read. I'm not teaching now. I used to teach Can't Stop, Won't Stop, and I had a whole hip-hop class around it. I could just spend a whole couple of weeks on those two chapters. It feels like they reminded me of of blues people.
Yeah.
The classic book by Mary Baraka, who was writing
Yeah.
as Leroy Jones back then. You have this line, "Here's a story of how, even without our drums, we still found a way to speak to each other across any distance placed between us." And that rang differently for me reading this in the last 2 months amidst coronavirus. And, you know, and thinking about, you know, distance and the kinds of things that get placed between us. You've written about that as well a lot in your work. Can you tell me a little bit about how you're thinking about distance these days, and sort of also what the distance is between the music listener, the music critic, and the artist?
Yeah, well, I mean, this day, I think about, I used to get so romantic about distance, you know.
Mm-hmm.
My current partner and I, we first met and were we were long distance for the first like 2 years of our relationship, and it was, and so many of my friends now live scattered along the country, and you know, distance felt, before distance was a necessity, it was romantic to me. And now I have a hard time aligning those ideas, and I begin to think about distance as something to grieve, and distance as a source of trauma in a way, because, you know, some of my closest, most longtime friends are here in Columbus, the people who I've loved my entire life. And when I go to see them, I have to talk to them through a screen door, or I have to talk to them, you know, I have to talk to people I love who live down the street from me only on Skype or Zoom or what have you. And so, you know, it's easy to be romantic about distance when it's not required, I suppose. And it has caused me to really think about closeness, physical closeness, as a type of privilege in a way I didn't think about before. In terms of music, you know, the thing that I always say about writing, about any art, is that once you're done creating it, once you've done the work of creating it and you've chosen to put it into the world, you no longer have control over the response to it. You have to do the best you can do and hope that the world receives it as you dream it to be received. But you also have to be prepared for how to live your life when that dream is not fulfilled, if that dream is not fulfilled. And so with music in particular, I have begun to almost, from a critical standpoint at least, to almost separate myself from, because we see so much of the inner workings of a musician's thoughts, or we see so much of the process of making an album. And I'm really in love with all of that. I mean, as my writing would suggest, I think I'm someone who loves a behind the scenes look, a peek behind the curtain. But I think I spend so much time now as a listener asking myself what response music is pulling out of me, and not what response is the music asking me for, right? I'm really chasing that kind of like immediacy. And in some ways, I think that makes me feel closer to the creator of, you know, and I'm saying this as someone who creates things and then sends them out into the world. I think it's all of our jobs to reach for a type of intimacy, but also be prepared for what that intimacy can create, right? Because you might not always get the type of intimacy you're looking for. And that, you know, is just a part of the process.
It's making me think about so many things. You got this beautiful poem in A Fortune for a Disaster, which actually, in light of The Last Dance, the series on Michael Jordan, yeah, on ESPN, sort of has a new profound kind of resonance. And it begins about this meditation on the push off, the moment where Michael Jordan pushes off on Brian Russell, still debated whether or not he actually pushed off or not, of course. Although the documentary seems to pretty much fall down on the, yeah, he pushed off, whatever, yeah, you know, type of vibe. But you start off with that. And I'm thinking about, you know, and you use that sort of reflection on distance to actually talk about the passing of your mother and the relationship that you have with your parents. The sort of, you're talking about distance and intimacy and love. And I just, it's just so powerful. It's one of those poems that really, really, it's very moving. It's really powerful.
Thank you. It's I think the poem, or like any writing, but in poems, I think I'm most excited by what I can find and use as a window to kind of crack an opening to get to something else or something different or something surprising. Because on its face, you know, do I actually care if Michael Jordan pushed off? Not really. I mean, I think even if he did, it was so inconsequential, right? Like, but when I think about the shared grief of losing a parent and how that sole thing connects me to Michael Jordan for a brief moment, that is more interesting to me. So it's all about how can I pry this window open just enough so I can slip through and get to something better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that for anybody who's lost anybody close like that, particularly a parent, it's beautiful the way that you were able to kind of use that particular moment to kind of dive into that. It still affects me really deeply, clearly, as you can tell. The other thing that I was thinking about, Hanif, was your essay on Bruce Springsteen. I'm going to see Bruce Springsteen literally the day that you drive back from Ferguson, going to see Bruce Springsteen play in Pennsylvania. And that made me think a little bit more too about the relationship between the artist and the critic, and the distance that is played there. I actually grew up a huge fan, of course, of Native Tongues. De La Soul is like still probably my favorite group of all time. And I got the opportunity to go and interview them for Vibe one time. And it ended up being probably the worst experiences I had ever had.
Oh no, really?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a type of situation where, I mean, Ali was Ali. He was wonderful. He was generous. He was warm. Q-Tip was wanting to fight argumentatively and that kind of thing, not physically, the whole time. Was very antagonistic, made it really difficult. And Fife, and this is why the book affected me so much. Like, you captured all of the personalities so deeply with so much empathy and understanding. Fife was, he hadn't eaten. And so he was probably having some sort of insulin shock, and he was very withdrawn, and I couldn't get a word out of him at all. So I didn't mean to tell that story, but I thought you should know.
No, that's a great story.
Just because you should. But in this moment where you're there watching Bruce Springsteen, you're led to think about literally what is it for Bruce Springsteen to be able to sing about hope? And you've just come back from Ferguson, and you write the line, what must it feel like to imagine that no one in America will be killed while a man sings a song about the promise of living? And in that moment, I mean, you know, that was an emotional moment for me as a reader, but it also made me realize too that in that sense, the artist and the critic are literally standing face to face. They're looking at each other in the eye. It's not a situation in which the critic is lesser than the artist because they are commenting on what the artist said. That in this case, there's a deep dialogue that's been initiated, and that you do this so well throughout all of your writing. But particularly, I think, in this essay and in Go Ahead in the Rain. So those are the kind of things that I've been thinking about in reading the works again in this moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think we owe that to the artists we love, right? We owe I love Bruce Springsteen. There's maybe no artist more important to me than Bruce Springsteen. And I think through that love, through like much any love, there are complications. And I think the real interesting and exciting part of criticism is when a speaker or a writer can bring those criticisms or those complications to life, and attempt to articulate them in a way that still honors the artist, right? It still honors the history that one has with an artist they love, but also ask questions of that affection.
So in Fortune for Your Disaster, which came out last year, you have a series of poems that are entitled "How Can Black People Talk About Flowers at a Time Like This?" What sort of led to this series of poems? What were you trying to get at? What was the theme that initiated it for you? And where did you find yourself going with that particular inquiry?
Yeah, actually, that's something I was at a reading, and I think late 2016, right after the election, or maybe early 2017. And it was a reading by a black poet who often writes about the natural world and who writes generously about nature as a source of gratitude despite everything around surrounding us. And I was sitting behind a white woman, and she whispered that phrase, or thought she was whispering. She was actually yelling,
She was
but
yelling.
she. Yeah, it was like one of those, like, I don't know. But she had whispered that phrase, whisper yelled that phrase to the person she was sitting next to. And, I think the easy, at first I was like, well, it's, my first instinct was, I can't believe a person would say that out loud. You know what I mean? And I went home and I was like, well, the easy thing for me to do would to be to write the poem, to write the, like, to the white woman who whispered this thing type poem. You know what I mean?
It was a white woman. Okay.
But the more challenging thing for me, I thought, was to think about flowers. As someone who didn't grow up with a relationship to flowers, did not grow up around flowers, did not grow up seeing many flowers, did not grow up in a place where flowers grew. And as someone who has a relationship to flowers that is largely understood through using flowers as a way to cover up and or get out of something, right? Using flowers as a way to mask something. If I did something to hurt someone, I'll bring them flowers. If I don't want to clean my apartment, but I have people coming over, I'll get some large flowers, right? These kind of things. And I began to think of flowers as a tool of beauty that people uproot from their home and then bring them into somewhere else to cover up for the flaws of a person or a space. And so in that way, I think flowers are very American, and flowers are also something that I thought I wanted to explore through the lens of blackness and discovery, and through how my own life can be intertwined with the flower. And some of that too was just my interest in wondering how far I could push my curiosity about flowers in general. So a lot of the writing of these poems led to a bunch of research about flowers, or a bunch of trying to find out more about flowers. And truthfully, I still don't know a lot. But I don't know more about flowers, but I know more about the imagery in the metaphor, and how I could push it further in an exploration of American life.
You've got this amazing essay in They Can't Kill Us Till They Kill Us, which itself was a note that you saw when you went to Ferguson and you were on Canfield Drive, where Michael Brown had been shot, and there was a little memorial there, and you saw that note. But you've got this essay, "Tell 'Em All to Come Get Me," which deeply, deeply impacted me the first time I read it, and actually really influenced me to do "We Gonna Be All Right," my book of essays that came out, because it's an essay that's literally about the notion of all right versus doing all right versus doing good. It starts kind of with the observation that you celebrate when people give each other greetings, when black folks give each other greetings. You write, "I celebrate expressions of unbridled black joy because I know what it takes to unlock this, to have the joy of the body drown out the anxiety of the mind if only for a little bit. And you talk about Black music as a map to Black freedom. And you then you talk about how what you notice is anytime you talk to other folks, to Black folks, and greet them, people say, "I'm doing all right. How you doing?" Yeah. "I'm doing all right." Whereas when you might talk to white folks, they'd be like, "I'm doing good. I'm doing great," and that kind of thing. And the difference between doing good and doing all right is a difference kind of in an understanding about what the world is happening. So I had this question, and it's kind of blended with the question that came from the audience. The last one was an audience question as well, which is sort of about hope and optimism. You've got an essay called Searching for a New Kind of Optimism as well. I'm wondering if you might actually be able to read it. And then I have this audience question that I wanted to ask you after you read a portion of that.
Yeah, I have a portion of it I'm going to read near the end. "My friends say I've gotten too cynical, and I suspect this might be true, judging by how quickly many people get exhausted when talking to me about the future. I am working on it, truly. A therapist tells me to challenge my inner cynic, but when I do, I simply find another inner cynic behind that one. I am, it turns out, a nesting doll of cynics. There is no evidence to suggest that humans are going to become any more kind this year, or more empathetic, or more loving toward each other. If anything, with our constant exposure to all of one another's most intense moments, the bar for what we seem prepared to tolerate gets lower with every second we spend screaming into each other's open windows. Yes, without question, 2016 was a year that dragged on more heavily than most before it. It felt exhausting and like it would never end, but all past logic was pulling us towards that breaking point, a year that finally pushed us to the edge, and all logic in this moment points to another year that might not feel quite as long, but will surely be just as trying. I have been thinking then about the value of optimism while cities burn, while people are fearing for their lives and the lives of their loved ones, while discourse is reduced to laughing through a chorus of anxiety. A woman in a Cape Cod diner the day after Christmas saw me eyeing the news and shaking my head. She told me, 'Things will get better.' And I wasn't sure they would, but I nodded and said, 'They surely can't get any worse,' which is the lie that we all tell, the one that we want to believe, even as there are jaws opening before us."
Hmm. Thank you for that. So the audience question was, how's the search for optimism going? And here we are, right? On May 29th, yeah. Right? The day after cities are on fire again.
Yeah, it's not going well. I think, but I also think, I also don't think I need it.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, something that's changed for me in the past few years. Mm. I'm not necessarily propelled by these really broad ideas of hope or optimism as much as I am by the people around me having the things they need to push forward and having the things they need to feel like they're capable of maneuvering the world. And so I don't know if that is tied to any optimism as much as it's tied to just a sharing of resources and a locating of needs and fulfilling what the needs are. And so the search for optimism isn't going well. uh-huh. But I don't know if I need optimism like I used to.
Mm. So we all know, maybe not all of us know, but certainly you and I know the Tony K. Bambara quote that about what the role is of an artist, which is to make revolution irresistible. I was just wondering, like, what your kind of thoughts are about that in this particular moment. Maybe it's a variation of the question that the white woman whispered, yelled in that reading, right? What is the role of an artist in this particular kind of a moment while cities are burning, while we're like being thwarted on our search for optimism, if we even need it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the biggest thing is that the artist, the job of the artist is in some way to, well, the job of the artist, as I see it, my job is to serve the communities I believe in and to be prepared to do that even if there's not an investment in the art I make, right? Mm-hmm. To be prepared to do that even if the art itself is secondary, or whenever the art becomes secondary. Because at the end of the day, like, I'm someone who writes about the excitement of music and how music moves me. That's at the core of my, you know what I mean? I'm not a political writer. I'm not a political reporter. I'm not someone who is reporting on the ground of protest. And so in some ways, my work as a writer feels very separate from my work as someone involved in justice movements and freedom fighting, because my work isn't laying down a blueprint for any of this. Mm-hmm. It is kind of, for me at least, if there is one way, it's linked. It is linked because I think all of the fights I take up and all the movements I'm a part of inform the way I hear and inform the way I view the world. And so I kind of have no choice but to braid that into my understanding of song and of musical history. But I don't get, if there's one thing, I hope that maybe I write something that gives people a rabbit hole to go down that offers some reprieve from a fight that they are in the midst of, right? Because that's what it does for me so much, you know what I mean? So much of writing for me is just falling down this spiral of rabbit holes, of videos, of old interviews, of old photos. That really pulls me to a better place. That pulls me out of a place that I think otherwise would be clouded with despair. And so I think that is my role, and that is a role I'm interested in fulfilling mostly for myself and inviting other people to join me.
I'm super thankful for you framing it all that kind of way. And you know, the questions that folks are asking from the audience and here from me, one of the things that I noticed is that, well, we'll put it this way. In the introduction to the essay book, They Can't Kill Us, your good friend Eve Ewing, who's also an amazing poet, brilliant scholar, she has this beautiful description of you. She talks of you as being something like somewhere between like an empath, an illusionist. And I just love that description of you, because and she goes on to say, you seem to know our secrets, and so I feel like these questions are coming from that place, that folks want to know what you're seeing of us in this particular moment. But I got to turn this back around and ask, what are you working on right now? I think you were supposed to have a book out at this time, and things, of course, have all changed and that kind of thing. Tell us a little bit about that particular book project. And then I've got, go ahead. No, that's it. Go ahead.
So I actually pushed, it's wild, I pushed that book for, like, you know, I hit up Random House and asked them to push the book to next year, even before COVID, because it was a book, I was like, I don't know if I want this book to come out during an election year. Mm-hmm. And so we had already kind of pushed it a year. And then all of this happened. And so, you know, I suppose there's some fortune in that. But the book is a book of long form work about the various modes. And so it's celebrating various modes of Black performance throughout American history. So there's a piece about spades. There's a piece about Josephine Baker coming back to America and speaking at the March on Washington. Mm-hmm. There's a piece about magic and the trope of the magical Negro. There's a piece about James Brown and Joe Tex in their beef, and also the Apollo, and also dancing. So it's really, I think, it's a book that I'm really excited about. It's a book I think that really acts as a roadmap of praise for the way that people I love have performed throughout history. And of course, there's some pain interwoven in that, but I think that it's largely a celebration. It's called A Little Devil in America, and it comes out next spring. The title comes from a portion of Josephine Baker's speech at the March on Washington, where she tells the audience, "You can ask your grandparents about me, and they will say that I was a little devil," and they were right. So I was a little devil in many countries, and I was a little devil in America too. So that'll be out next spring. Right now, I'm finishing. I was actually going to drop it today, like launch it today, but I held off because of everything happening. But I've been long working on this like playlist music archival hub, so to speak. So when I was in Iowa, I was in Iowa teaching at the beginning of the school semester until I was not in Iowa teaching.
Right.
When I was there, you know, I was like alone most nights. You know, I was there in a small apartment alone with not much to do. And I began mapping out, I began asking myself, okay, what are, if I had to pick a large window of years that most defined how I came to my understanding of music and defined my musical tastes, what would those years be? And so I'm talking the years that my parents came to love music, the years that perhaps their parents came to love music, the years that my siblings came to love music, how all this music that got passed down to me helped me build a map to music of my own and then defined my musical tastes as I love them and know them now. Wow. And I landed on the years 1968 to 2005. And so I hit this point. At first, it was just for fun where I was like, I'm just going to make playlists. I'm going to make these really all, this extensive, all-inclusive playlists of like 80 songs each of the what I think are the most important songs of every year from 1968 to 2005. And I got through about four playlists because they take a long time to make because I'm a playlist make, you know. I got through about four playlists and then the pandemic happened and I had to come back home and you know, all these things. And I was like, man, I could really like expand this. And so I went on Squarespace and I'm bad at making websites. So it took me like a month and a half to make a website. And on the website, cause I was like, this can't just be about playlists. Right. Cause at first I was just sharing a playlist one by one on the internet and people were like, oh, I'm really into this. Like, let's, you know, keep them coming, whatever, whatever. And so I made this site that is a music archival site that will not only house the playlists for each year, but also have a lot of archival concert footage from that year, magazine covers. And so I found a bunch of archival magazine covers to put on the site, but also because I hit a point where I was like, this has to go beyond my obsession. Right. And so a project, and it has to be ongoing. I want this to be ongoing and not just a place people go to once, see some stuff and then leave. And so part of the project is that throughout the life of however long this is, hopefully years, I'm going to hit up my writer friends and musician friends and poet friends and give them a 5-year window. I'm just send them an email, send them a text or whatever and be like, you have from 1984 to 1989. And they will have to pick an album within that window and write like 700 to 1,000 words in praise of it. And that'll go up on the site as well every now and then. So I wanted to create this kind of idea of communal fandom that wasn't just centered on my own obsessions. And so excited.
What's the site?
It's called 68to05.com. And I got like a, I'm going to launch it with more info probably next week. And my homie Vivian Lee is writing the first piece. I think about Holes Live Through This. And I got folks writing about, yeah, I mean, trust me, if you have downtime and you want to write something,
I'd do anything for you, man. That sounds like an amazing site.
I've been trying to lean on folks. Like, listen, if you got downtime, and you want to write like a short thing in praise of an album that, and some of it too, is just getting people who don't often get to write about this stuff or people who feel like, because the thing that I ran into is that I always want to read people writing in praise of an album that means a lot to them, but so rarely, it happens so rarely because in the context of the current media landscape, it's like, oh, you can't write about that unless there's an anniversary or you can't write about that unless there's like a, so I wanted to give people this kind of endless opportunity to be like, yo, if you are feeling good about an album that came out in 1973 that you want to write about, please do it because I want to read it for sure. Mm-hmm. So my hope is that this kind of serves a purpose and it goes beyond my obsession with making playlists.
That sounds amazing. Just nerd out heaven for me, for sure. A huge time suck too. I'm sure it's been a massive project for you, but this is the kind of thing where people will be spending hours upon hours upon hours upon hours hanging out on that. That sounds amazing. That sounds really great. Two last questions for you. Very quick questions. Maybe they're going to be the most difficult ones, by the way. The first question is, Low End Theory or Midnight Marauders. And here we're and here we're like we're actually looking like we're auditioning for the cover of a new Midnight Marauders with the headphones on and that kind of thing. We wouldn't have been doing this otherwise. But yeah, Low End Theory or Midnight Marauders.
That is a tough question, but fortunately, I've rehearsed an answer.
Okay.
I think Low End Theory is probably the better album, but I like Midnight Marauders more because I think Midnight Marauders is the better Fife album. I'm a big Fife guy, and I think Fife was best on Midnight Marauders. I mean, I think that's when he was like really at his sharpest. So Midnight Marauders is perhaps the album I want to listen to more often, even though I think Low End Theory is probably better. It's one of those things. I mean, that happens all the time. I think My Dark Twisted Fantasy is probably the best Kanye West album, but it's not the one I most want to listen to. It's not the one I return to the most excitedly.
What would that be?
I think, I mean, for me, it's probably like Dropout, College Dropout, or
Dropout or
Graduation.
Graduation? Yeah, that makes sense. And the last one, which again may be the toughest question of all, just one Desert Island Disc. And this is from the audience. Just one.
This is hard, but I think today, the one
Today.
that most comes to mind today, is Graceland by Paul Simon.
A sentence why? Or two?
Yeah, so I think that Graceland does something for me when it sparks a lot of joy in my memory. I mean, I remember people I love listening to it as I was growing up, and I also just love it, despite the fact that it was made under some really not great and uneven circumstances. So the history, and I also want to take an album to a desert island that will make me think about its creation. And I think Graceland fits that bill.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for your time, Hanif. It's been incredible to be able to spend this time with you on a day like this, in times like these. And your writing has given me a lot of joy. It's helped to be a catalyst for me to experience and vicariously process a lot of different types of emotions and feelings. It's inspired a book of mine. I'm just so thankful to be able to have this time with you today.
Jeff, I appreciate it so much. Thank you for spending time with me.
You've been listening to Hanif Abdurraqib in conversation with Jeff Chang. This program was recorded on May 29th, 2020. The two spoke to one another from their homes under orders to shelter in place during the COVID-19 pandemic. These broadcasts are produced by City Arts and Lectures in association with KQED Public Radio, San Francisco. Executive producers are Kate Goldstein-Brier and Holly Muldaur-Wallin. Director of Communications and Design is Alexandra Washkin. Production and Communications Assistant is Juliet Gelfman-Randazzo. The Post-Production Director is Nina Thorson. The Sydney Goldstein Theater Technical Director, Steve Eckard. House Manager, Lucy Faulkner. The Recording Engineer is Jim Bennett. Theme music composed and performed by Pat Gleason. The Founding Producer is Sydney Goldstein. To attend a live program, see who is coming next, or find out more about our podcast, visit our website at cityarts.net. That's cityarts.net.
Special thanks to Anne Oyama for making our programs possible as we shelter in place at home.